Howdy, neighbor, and welcome to the Librarian is In, the New York Public Library's podcast about books, culture, and what to read next. I'm Frank.
And I'm Rhonda.
And did you know what Howdy Neighbor's from? Howdy, yeah. Neighbor, happy harvest. May your 40 acres soon be fields of clover.
Oh, okay.
You're a musical person.
I know, you said 40 acres.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Tell me.
Oh, God, the audience is going to be like, whatever. It's Judy Garland from Summer Stock, a movie called Summer Stock.
Oh, I've heard of Summer Stock.
She's writing on the track.
I'm not familiar with the songs. So when you said 40 acres, I thought I might have to do something with like black people.
Oh. Well, that's interesting. I mean, that's an interesting thing because it's true. May your 40 acres soon be fields of clover. I wonder if, because 40 acres and a mule.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Was the promise.
I was going to say something like, I don't know, I was trying to think of like an older black musical and then I just gave up.
I wonder if, that's an interesting thing, if that was a standard of farms and, or if it was a sort of, I don't know, sketchy reference from the songwriters for a white musical, basically. Huh.
That's a great question. I don't know.
See?
I mean, that was the first thing that I thought of, but maybe there is some kind of larger farming context of 40 acres.
It's a very interesting thing because that's, I sort of sang it as a, didn't even think about the words. And then when you commented on it, I realized, yes, that's a specific detail that does have historical resonance and that wonder what that, you see, there's a whole story in the writing of that song probably. Well, if anyone out there knows about it, let us know.
Exactly. Let us know.
I just went with my musical instincts and, should I say, prodigious talents.
And then you said Howdy Neighbor, and I was also thinking Mr. Rogers. I had lots of things going on.
Wow, I'm such an inspiration to you, Rhonda.
No.
Hardly. Well, I just, you know, I didn't know that was going to pop out of my mouth because I was sort of like half dead with, I don't know, just life, half dead with life when we started recording. And so Howdy Neighbor came out, which I guess made me happier.
That does make, you know, saying Howdy Neighbor, greeting someone.
Yeah.
I can see how that can kind of like uplift your spirits. But, you know, it's a new year, which is a little, you know, kind of exciting. We'll see. I hope.
I think everybody, the thing about that is that everybody's sort of very careful about saying, ha, it's a new year, everything's going to change, like being very wary about that. Just sort of be a little vigilant.
Right.
Because we don't know. Even though, as I said, like the spring is sort of this point in time that, because our library renovation should be complete, my library, Jefferson Market, and just in my head, the completion of the library in the spring and the world, everything will burst into song and we really will be like, howdy neighbor, happy harvest.
I know the community is going to be so excited when Jefferson Market opens up again.
I hope so. I realize that our beautiful second floor, which is really the showplace of the library, because of various permutations of the renovation and pandemic, will have been closed for over 2 years by the time
it opened.
I know. Aww. I should put pictures of that room if people don't know it. It's so beautiful with stained glass windows and high ceilings and lots of books and lovely tables. But yes, you know, whatever it is, I'm going to hopefully enter into it with renewed energy and see what the next phase of library world will be, which is a question to itself, because, I mean, this is an interesting thing. You know, all the prognosticating articles and information we take in about what's happening right now, about all industries and people's work and people's lives, like how everyone says, oh, it's definitely changed because of this, but like how it will actually manifest is to be seen. I mean, what will stay from this time, what will fall away, what will return, what won't return. And that's probably the most exhausting frustrating part of it is that we just can't say, oh, well, A follows B, you know what I mean? A, B, C, and this happens. We don't really know because we haven't been through something like this. So, but you learn not to really think that way. You just have to sort of keep your passions in line and hopefully they manifest. Actually, the book I read has somewhat to do with this, or I'm fake relating things like I always do.
No, I'm intrigued because, I mean, things are definitely going to change, but, you know, and then some things will stay the same. So,
wow, Rhonda, you just summed that up.
I just summed it up. Some things will change, some will stay the same.
Well, I mean, you're right. I mean, I guess the specifics we will discover, but yes, it's an interesting, frustrating, and not and maybe heartbreaking time for some people. So,
exactly.
I don't want to choose one adjective over another because everyone's having various experiences with this, and we're not even saying the name. Good. Anyway, so how are you otherwise, or is that a silly question?
You know, the holidays is always an interesting time because it can be, you know, really, really nice, but also can be kind of stressful. So sometimes like right after the holidays, there's like a little bit of release of kind of all the stress and then the end of the year. So probably just like everyone else, just taking it day by day.
Yeah. You know? Holidays aren't stressful for me anymore because a lot of the stressors of family and stuff don't really exist anymore. But it's just depressing. Oh, God. I mean, I usually look forward to time off and I love New York during the holidays because it's empty and now, it's quiet and empty in lots of other ways. So I don't know, whatever. It doesn't have to dig deep in that. It's just everyone has their emotions and holidays can be joyous, certainly. So I just watched a bunch of movies that I don't think I even remember, you know,
it was an escape.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess it was. But I guess we've been doing some reading as well, which has been challenging, just focusing sometimes.
Oh yeah.
And I know signing off the last time off tape or whatever, we had both alluded that you were reading a fiction book, I believe. And I had said, oh my God, because I'm reading I have read a nonfiction book, which I don't often read. I was just sort of in the mood for like real people going through life and what that was about. I just wanted to somehow read about people that actually existed and facts that were hopefully divined by the author and displayed accurately or as accurately as possible, as accurately as we can. Mm-hmm. And read something like that. So it was just a whimsical choice that I made. I was actually doing something the library has, which is called the Shelf Help. Are you involved?
Yes. The research libraries are not because we don't circulate our books.
Right.
But I'm definitely familiar with Shelf Help, which I think is amazing, but you work on that. You should tell everyone.
Yeah, exactly. It's actually turned out to be really cool. They developed it and it's fantastic. It sort of like takes the place of browsing because we still don't have browsing yet in the branch libraries. It's just picking up holds and checking them out and skedaddling. So you can't really browse or linger. So Shelf Help is this thing where you can fill out a little form about books you like, last books you read for children as well as adults, and leave it in a little tray. And the librarians you could do it online too. And the librarians at that location will collect five titles that we think you might be interested in, which can be very challenging. It's sort of like one of the most, at least for me, like anxiety making because you want to be right. And some people will write like, I love romance. And we know there's like so many different types of romance. So it's like, what kind of romance? Like Regency, sexy time romance, that kind of thing. So, but then I discovered it's fun just to sort of go with something I think they might like. And some of the feedback we got is like, oh yeah, two of the books you picked I read already, which, you know, is okay. It's really, like I said, browsing. So you get five books. it doesn't mean you're forced to read all five. Please, it's very much a selection of books that we think you might like, and some you might like and some you don't. And some people will check out, like, oh, I'm going to check out four of these. This other one, I'm not so interested. Or I've read, whatever. So someone had requested science, new science. And that's all they said. So I was just sort of thinking about it, looking around the shelves, thinking, because I often don't read about science. Are you a science person?
Well, for a long time, I was really interested in space. So I was reading books by like Neil deGrasse Tyson. He wrote the book, Death by Black Hole, which is like a really, I mean, it's still, you know, a little over my head, but it is a really great introduction to kind of like the planets and astrophysics. And so in terms of science, I definitely had a phase where I was obsessed with like the planets and outer space and the cosmos.
Oh, cool. I had not read a lot. And I, you know, science as actually this book is a jumping off for the author about how she, when she was in undergrad, science classes could be very dry and almost drove her away. As she actually says in the preface that science classes in college are designed to weed out the sort of not so interested because they're so challenging and dry and laborious. So her goal was to write a book on science that everybody could read. And that, of course, appeals to me because I'm like, hey, don't get too technical on me.
Right.
And also the title of the book appeals to me because it has a sociological, historical aspect to it, too, like how science and human life interact, like how science impacts our day-to-day life. So the title of, I guess I'll launch in, the title of it is The Alchemy of Us. The Alchemy of Us, How Humans and Matter Transformed One Another.
Okay.
By Anissa Ramirez. And I like, when I saw the subtitle, I was like, How Humans and Matter Transformed One Another. I thought that was sort of interesting. So in my search for recommending books for someone in the library, I found a book for myself. So I read it, and Anissa Ramirez is a materials scientist, which sort of lies between like physics and chemistry, apparently. Hmm. And it deals with the actual stuff of usually solids of what everything is sort of made of. And she was interested in actually, she became passionate because she was one of those kids who had questions when she was younger about like, why is gum chewy? Like, why do rubber soles on our shoes feel comfortable? Like what makes these things? Like what makes these things that impact our daily life, the actual objects? So it crosses like chemistry, like I said, metals, you know, polymers, plastics, things like that. So it's objects and materials. We are living in a material world. She actually mentions Madonna, and that's
I know that song.
she writes like very accessibly because it's like I said, science. And so at one point she does say like as that she said something like she's very funny. She can write very funny. She said as that sage of the 20th century said, "Yes, we are living in a material world." I was like, she shouts out Madonna as the sage of the times. I should say there's an extensive bibliography at the back of this book. And there's also, there's no footnotes, which might bother people, but there's notes at the end, which I actually like. This is an interesting aside about what we like, how we like a book formatted. I find footnotes literally at the bottom of the page distracting. Like if
you're tempted to read them.
Right. And I'm thinking if someone wanted to include what's in the footnote that badly, they would have incorporated it into the text. So you don't need it right away. It's something you can refer to later. But the footnote then sort of jumps you out of the text, puts you down at the bottom of the page, and you get an aside. And you're like, okay. I mean, some people might prefer that, I think. I'm sure they do. She has her notes, not footnotes, but notes at the end about each chapter and page. So I sort of like that. Mm-hmm. It also has the classic format of the pictures are of things she talks about are in the middle of the book.
Oh, in color.
Sort of like, I mean, I grew up on books like that. Like instead of like when you're reading, then you have a picture on the next page. When you're in like the middle of the book, you suddenly encounter the 20-page picture section, which sort of gave me pleasure.
Mm-hmm. It is kind of fun to kind of, because it's something that you kind of look forward to, of getting to that section of the book with all the photographs.
I just thought it was a it's MIT Press. Very impressive, right? Mm-hmm. So it was just a well-made book. It's a well-made book structurally and visually. So anyway, The Alchemy of Us, she has basically 8 chapters or so of sort of broadly titled, like one chapter is called Interact, another one's called Capture, another one's called Share. And within those chapters, she'll discuss like a material, a metal, a mineral, something natural that turned into an invention, and then how that invention impacted our lives. So on the chapter I said on Connect or Interact is really about clocks, which starts with quartz crystals that eventually were developed. There's some science in the book. It's not like overkill science, at least for a lay person. But even their simplified explanations of it were sometimes like eye glazing for me. I was like, huh? Like the quartz vibrates at 100,000 vibrations a second, and that delivers accurate time. I'm like, well, if you say so. I mean, I'm shocked I even remember that. But so that part, I was sort of like, I appreciate you, Anissa Ramirez, for informing me about science, but I'm going to wait for the history and the cultural context.
Right.
But there are science people who want to know these things, and it's certainly a jumping off point to discover more specifically. So the chapter on clocks, with the quartz as its basic end springs, metal spring as its basic component that gave us time. And then, of course, she talks about time as well. We know some stories we know, like how time fiddles with our sleep. Did you know that I think you might have known this. I knew this fact, that up until clocks really became prevalent, you know, like late 1800s, people slept in two shifts. Like they slept for a couple of hours, then woke up in the middle of the night, sort of puttered around the house without really doing too much, like did a little housework, maybe read a book, and then went back to sleep. They always was commonly known to sleep in two shifts, and the second part was called second sleep.
I don't think I knew that. Is that because is our body is supposed to kind of naturally do that?
Well, yeah, she talks about circadian rhythms and how they're sort of like a natural thing that happened before we had clocks to sort of dictate when we went to bed and when we got up. Also, in a later chapter, she talks about light bulbs, and how light sort of impinged on that too, that we were able to, with light, stay up until 2 o'clock in the morning, like I do, and go to sleep rather than sort of using the sun as your guide.
Right.
Another parenthetical. What?
Yeah, like people used to just, when it was dark, that's when you went to bed.
Yeah, and rose with the sun. I mean, up until clocks too, sort of ingrained themselves in life. Different cities in the same state or different towns had different times. So if you were traveling like by stagecoach, which could take days and days through a state, you'd have different time zones within that state because everybody sort of calibrated their time by high noon. So obviously the sun moves. So like every town would have a different time. So like it's 11:57, which is noon in one town, and then 12:04 in another town. It was like no one was on sync.
What?
And that's another thing that changed human life, when everyone became in sync. I don't know an in sync song, so I'm not going to say it.
But, this is wild. You're blowing my mind here with these facts.
Well, let me blow it further. Because in terms of getting traditional time, she then drills down into, after she talks about the science of creating time, about certain stories like the one I just told about time. And one of them is, there was a woman named Ruth Belville in England, because Greenwich Mean Time was the sort of center of the correct time of the world. And she had a job and her daughter after her, or her mother before her. But for like, you know, a good 80 years, she would go with her clock, she named Arnold, her watch, and go to Greenwich Mean Time office and synchronize her watch. And then she would go back into town, London, all over London, walking to different establishments who would pay her to deliver the correct time.
What?
That was her job. So everybody could synchronize. She would just literally go to like Mr. Jensen's grocery store, and then she'd go to, you know, Abby's Bar and Grill, and, you know, and give them the correct time. And, and it was important to a lot of establishments, like especially the bar, because there were liquor laws where you couldn't sell booze before or after a certain time, and they needed to know exactly what time it was. And that was her job, because they couldn't access actual time. There wasn't a phone you could call for the correct
time. That's what I was going to say. Remember, there used to be a number you could call.
Right, which is a little bit later like than 1880. Is.
Yeah, I remember that. So,
while you stew on that, and then, I mean, there's 8 chapters, like I said, I can't obviously go through all of them, that she gets into steel. I found the steel chapter really compelling, which was about creating railroads. I mean, first of all, railroads in the 1800s were made of iron, which I found out scientifically, and that she gives detail. Iron decays after 2 years or so, but steel lasts 18 years, like a generation. So the goal was to find the perfect recipe for steel. And scientists all over the world were trying to discover this. And it's like, as far as my feeble brain can like think of, like it's all about like the measurement of different mixtures, like iron plus carbon equals steel, but you have to get the perfect recipe of it. If it's too much, it'll be brittle. If it's too little, it'll be gooey. You know what I mean? Like it's, but then they know about molecules and, but not then, that they knew about more like measurements and beakers and put heating it and cooling it, adding air, adding water, you know, like cooking.
Right.
So steel was a big deal. And what's interesting, so that gave rise to the railroads. And one of the stories she tells is that when the railroads occurred, it was a big connector, obviously. And then the whole country could sort of partake of what other parts of the country had to offer. So like if Ohio had a flour industry, they could supply flour to the country, which might not have been as readily available in Florida. Florida would have their own export that could go to other parts of the country. So you could like sample Seattle cuisine or make it in Louisiana, you know, because the railroads can deliver all these products all over the country. Mm-hmm. And that became something more uniting between the United States, which occurring after the Civil War, sorely needed that kind of uniting again. And one of the first things that did do this was President Lincoln's assassination. Like the country was so aggrieved, at least the North, and wanted to be a part of his funeral. But if you lived in Seattle, you couldn't go to his burial place in Illinois, I believe. Or to DC for a funeral. I mean, that wasn't possible practically. Right. So the trains that were starting up certainly around that time, it was the first time that they had the president's body sort of shipped cross country on this train, and people would come and gather at the train tracks or in the station, or if they were in a big enough city where the train stopped and they could view his body. And it became like a giant event. People would travel for days just to get a glimpse of the train carrying his body. I mean, that is a cultural thing that you can contemplate in itself about a daily life where it would take such a journey to witness such a momentous moment, you know, and how that now we like get pictures transmitted in our phone right away. It's like, we don't even think about going to the funeral necessarily. You can, and I'm sure some people would, but they wouldn't even have seen his face in pictures because photography wasn't as predominant yet, which is another chapter in the book. Yeah. I just realized, I was like, what am I going to talk about? And then I start talking.
Yeah, so much.
I don't know. Now I'm very upset because I want to share so many chapters. There's so many good stories, actually. I should just say that she writes about anecdotes and stories and details of these inventors' personal lives to very much humanize inventions and the inventors with all their biases and problems. And also the names we know, like Edison or Samuel Morse, there are other people who, of course, at the same time were coming up with these ideas too. It wasn't just one sole inventor in the little attic room. There were people thinking of this all over the world, but then one name becomes attached to the fame of that invention. And she talks about how other people were thinking about it. Some people get the glory, some people don't. I mean, there's later a whole story about the inventor of photography between two people who had a 20-year war about the patent for it. I mean, really interesting. Oh my God, there's so many stories. I mean, I'll just say one final one. In The Alchemy of Us by Anissa Ramirez, the photography one was sort of cool because there were facts I did not know about. Like Kodak developed, when they started developing color pictures in the 50s, black families complained because when you get your student picture taken in color at that time, black mothers particularly were like, this is not a good photography of my kid. You can't see their face. It's a dark face. And she goes on to discuss how there was a color palette that was developed that all color photographers used. And it was basically a white woman's face with like blue eyes and colorful pillows. And like they would take the picture and match the controls to that standard, like an eye chart in an eye doctor's office. It was a standard, clearly biased. And Kodak would not, didn't really listen to the complaints. You know, when they changed their tune, when, what else? Money came into the thing.
Right, of course.
Furniture makers who produced dark wood furniture and chocolatiers who produced chocolate complained that they couldn't get definition in their darker colors. And then Kodak was like, oh, okay, we'll figure it out. Thanks. You know,
interesting.
And then that segued into a great chapter, and then I'm going to shut up, about Polaroid, who, piggybacking on this, you know, their instant photography, the Polaroid pictures, developed a button that you could push that would be a brightener to darker features of any sort, face, object, whatever. And that brightener button on Polaroid, which would give instant pictures. Usually they had a function called Polaroid ID, which would deliver two pictures. Excuse me, was appropriated or used by South Africa to track black people's locations in South Africa. One picture was given to them in a passbook, which was a book they had to show wherever they were to prove who they were and what their deal was. And another was on file with the government. And when two Polaroid workers, two black workers, chemist and a photographer, found out about this, they organized a coalition to battle Polaroid to stop selling to South Africa. They lost their jobs eventually, but they eventually won after 7 years of fighting where Polaroid divested from South Africa.
That's amazing. That is a story I didn't know.
Mic drop. Thank you.
Exactly.
So the book of The Alchemy of Us has a lot of stories like that about different inventions. And then that whole story about Polaroid starts with like the object, the materials that she as a material scientist is interested in, of filaments and minerals that went into the creation of the photographic image. So you get science, you get social, you get history. And then you got some great anecdotes for your next cocktail party in 2023.
Exactly. And it'll be that long. And it's interesting because you still hear those stories about these, kind of like what you were saying about the photograph and not recognizing the black people. You still hear their stories. I remember they were saying recently, like one of the self-driving cars that could kind of stop when they detected a person, like it wasn't detecting black people, you know? So that was a problem, obviously. And then there are other kind of technology issues that I've heard that are similar to that. So that's still happening, but it's also really interesting to, you know, just thinking about the science behind all of the things that we use and we access and, you know, we just, like myself, is just here and I enjoy it. My phone, my food that is not in season, you know, you don't really think about often what goes into these things, what goes into creating these things, bringing these things to us. So, and it's always great to have a good science writer, those who can make it accessible.
Yeah, she's really good. She has a great style. It's very slightly formal, which feels very respectful, but there's a sort of warmth to it. That when she tells the stories, it's great. I think it would be great for young adults too, as an introduction to scientific discovery. But just one thing about you were saying is, like, it's true. Like, when you take something like photography, in our dumb heads that don't know the science behind it, we would think you take a picture, you get an accurate representation of whatever you took a picture of, right?
Right.
But we don't know necessarily that that picture had a lot of science into it that actually deliberately chooses some things to highlight and some things to don't. So a picture is not just a mirror image of what you're looking at. It actually could be biased. Something you think that is not a biased, possibly to be biased, is because of the science that went into it. Like you just said about the cars. I mean, that's sort of a fascinating thing about, we think, oh, well, that's straightforward, but it's not. And that's what this book sort of digs into, that not everything's so straightforward. I mean, there's so many stories, like a battle that was in the 1800s that killed so many people during the War of 1812. And at the time this battle was going on, they had already signed in Europe the end of the War of 1812. So if there was, that leads into the telegraph discussion. If there was the capability of communication, quick communication, they wouldn't have had that battle because the war was over. They had it because they didn't know. It took 3 weeks for a message to get from one place to another because it was horseback. And over the ocean, because they were in Europe. So a whole group of soldiers were killed needlessly because the war had already ended, but they didn't know. I mean, can you imagine that today? Like, you know, how quick information goes?
How fast things. I mean, that could be just the way that communication has changed. I feel like we could talk about that for
forever.
For days.
Oh, I mean, don't get me started. She has a chapter on the internet. Oy!
Oh, I mean, you may have to do a part two on this, Frank.
Ah, thank you. You want me back. You really like me.
Got that reference.
Oh, Miss Sally Field.
Oscar.
She was right, though. I always hated that people made fun of her because she did come from the flying nun to an Oscar. Anyway, that's another story for another day.
Another day.
You did read a book too, I suppose.
I did. And I did read fiction. However, the fiction was based on actual events.
Oh, Rhonda.
So I know. I kind of cheated. Not really.
You're a research librarian. My God.
I know. But I read the Nickel Boys by Colson Whitehead, which was the 2019 Pulitzer Prize winner for fiction. And, you know, it's not the, let me say, preface this with two things. Number one, there is a really, really big twist at the end. And I am going to do my best to try not to spoil the book, but I want to give fair warning that I might by accident. So if you are planning to read the Nickel Boys and you don't want to hear the twist at the end, then you may want to come back and listen to this part after you have read the book. And the second preface that I wanted to say was, I just forgot. So I'm just going to go ahead. And I had the other part of my head. But I forgot what I was going to say. So
it's Colson Whitehead, the Nickel Boys. All right. Now I want to know what you forgot.
Yes, I know. I want to know what I forgot too. That was the first part that I was going to say, was that that was the most important thing, is that people, you know, should step away if they don't want it to be spoiled.
What about I don't want to hear it? I haven't read it yet.
Okay, I'll do my best.
You talk to yourself. No, actually, it's okay. I think it's funny, I forgot, but I read it.
That's an occupational hazard for you though, Frank.
Exactly. So I can take it. Dish it out.
Insulated from the spoils.
I respect you. If it happens, it happens.
It happens, but I'm going to do my best. Right. So I'm trying to think if I should start with what, I'm going to just jump into the story and get to the kind of factual part later, but it takes place in 1960s Florida. So we're in the South, in the middle of the Civil Rights Movement. And we start with the character of a teenage black boy named Elwood, And Elwood, you know, it's just him and his grandmother. His grandmother's a domestic worker in a hotel. And he is this character that you kind of get to realize early on is someone who is just really, really hopeful, optimistic, to a fault. And he, you know, his idol is Martin Luther King Jr. And his grandmother gives him this album of Martin Luther King Jr.'s speeches. And he listens to them all the time. Mm. And he, you know, he's very aware in the civil rights movement. He wants to go on marches, but he sees it as like hopeful, like we can change things. We can make this world better. And you kind of get these little moments early on that should kind of crush his hopes and bring him kind of more towards a realistic point of view. Mm. But he just remains hopeful. And one incident is he gets a job in the same hotel that his grandmother works in as a dishwasher. And he's the youngest person because he's a teenager, and all the other dishwashers are also black men. And they say to him, you know, someone in one of these hotel rooms has left an entire set of encyclopedias. And he's really smart and he's really bright and loves to learn and he's fascinated. And this one guy says, I really want these encyclopedias. And he's like, I want them. And they'll say, well, why don't we have this dishwashing contest? And whoever wins gets this set of encyclopedias. So they have this contest and it's like down to the last plate and he wins and he's so excited. He takes them home and he looks through the first one. It's amazing. But then he realizes that it's like a dummy set. So the only one that is real is the first one in the set, and all the rest of them are just covers with nothing inside, just blank pages.
Oh my God. Okay.
So, you know, we kind of get this first sense of his hopes of being crushed. And then another moment is, you know, he also has a job in this as a stock boy in this store, and he sees some of his kids in the neighborhood stealing. And usually, you know, the thing is to just kind of look the other way, but he makes this big deal of stopping them and they kind of like beat him up and destroy his bike for being a snitch. So he's always trying to do the right thing and it's just kind of, he suffers for it. So, you know, we kind of get to know Elwood in this way. It's this kind of hopeful boy who always wants to do the right thing, really just like a good kid. Mm-hmm. And his teacher recognizes how bright he is and what a good kid he is. And they say, you know, you could take college classes and you should go and you should, you know, take classes at the local university. And he's just so excited. And so he goes to his first day and he's you know, super excited and he's on his way home and he's going to walk and it's a long way home. And this car stops and it's like, it's a, you know, a man in this really nice car. And he says, you know, do you need a ride? He's like, thank you so much. That would be great. And it turns out
is that like explained as a common thing just to get into a stranger's car?
I mean, maybe in the 60s in the South, they trusted people more. Of course, now we would say don't ever like just jump into a stranger's car. Yeah. But I guess, you know, maybe at that time in that place,
it was an aberration or like, because suddenly it seemed like, this is the turning point.
Okay. And this is the turning point. Oh. This is the uh-oh part. This is the cautionary tale of do not get into a stranger's car.
Oh, no. Okay.
And the guy is like a, you know, just normal guy. And they're talking about, you know, going to school. And the car gets pulled over. And it turns out that the car is stolen. And so Elwood, who did nothing but just take a ride, gets sentenced to juvenile detention. I mean, juvenile institution, I believe for like 2 years or something like that. God. And this is where the story takes place. So he gets sent to Nickel Academy, which is a reform school. And kind of what happens at this reform school is pretty horrifying. That was what I was going to say. The thing that I was going to preface this with was, if you are, this book has a lot of triggers in it. Like there's a lot of kind of really violent moments and it's definitely not something you want to read if you are in the least way kind of depressed or anything like that. There's a lot of kind of, there's a lot of trauma in this book. Mm-hmm. So he gets sent to this place called Nickel. And, you know, when he first gets there, it's segregated, right? Because it's the South, it's the 60s, and there's a, you know, a school part for the white kids, and there's a school part for the Black kids, and they just, and there's a Puerto Rican kid who kind of keeps going. They don't know where to put him, so they take, you know, send him back and forth. But so they're in this school, and, you know, at first, of course, of always, he's kind of hopeful. And it's like, okay, you know, there's a, you can get out early. You just have to get these, like, points, you know. If they recognize you're doing the right thing, if you spend a certain amount of time staying out of trouble, you can kind of get these points to get out of the school. And also, you know, you can go to class. But Elwood, you know, kind of begins to learn very quickly, you know, how horrible, I guess, this place is. And the first thing that happens is, you know, he goes to class, and basically there is, it's not really school at all. They're not teaching them anything. And, you know, basically just people are goofing off. And then another thing is that he sees this boy getting beat up in the bathroom, and he tries to stop the fight. And you know, one of the people who worked there comes in and sees the three boys, and all of them automatically get into trouble. Mm-hmm. And here's like the big turning point, kind of when you see how horrible this place is that he gets put into, I forget what they call it. I believe they call it the White House. I don't have the name, but it's basically this place where no one ever wants to get sent, because the way that he is basically tortured for breaking up this fight is just kind of like mind blowing. Like,
and this is based on a true institution.
This is based on a true institution. And so for breaking up this fight, he is just, you know, physically destroyed, like on the brink of death. And Colson Whitehead, it's interesting because he doesn't describe the action. He does, you know, he gives you an idea of what's being done to him, but you don't get a lot of detail about the violence. But the way that you kind of get the reaction of Elwood, and, you know, the other kind of little details that he puts in, you get a sense of how violent this act is without actual kind of gory details, which I thought was, you know, just really skillful.
Or even more impactful, because it's the unknown, but you get his reaction, not sort of what actually they're doing to him. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. Like, you don't get gory details.
Your imagination makes it worse, probably.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Wanted to do, obviously. Okay.
Right. And it's interesting because Elwood, even with that, you know, he still holds on to these beliefs. And other things kind of happen in the school. So he has this friend who kind of becomes his best friend, whose name is Turner. And Turner is almost the exact opposite of Elwood. Turner is a survivalist. He is a realist. He is just saying, you know, basically, you know, you do what you have to do to get through this without getting hurt, right? You, like, you stay out of people's business. You don't try to stop fights. You don't try to help other people. You just do what you have to do to survive. And they kind of become best friends. And through each of their viewpoints, you kind of see what Nickel is like. And kind of another story that happens here is that every year they have this huge boxing match at Nickel between two boys who are in the school. And this one that they speak about, there's a Black one and there's a white one. And Elwood and Turner overhear that the people want to fix the fight. They want to make sure that the white student wins over the Black student. And they tell the Black student, you know, you're supposed to throw the fight in a certain round, like the third round. And so the kid, you know, goes in and he's agreed to do that. But for some reason, you know, he's just, his body is kind of stronger than his mind. He ends up, you know, actually winning the fight, even though he didn't mean to. And they kill him. They murder this kid for not throwing this fight. And again, they do it in a really, really horrific way. And so Elwood is kind of seeing all this. And he, again, thinks like, oh, I can really change things. Maybe if I get the truth out. So he kind of starts writing these letters to like newspapers, like anonymously, different things like that. And he tries to get his grandmother to, you know, get a word out for him, but she's smart too. She's like, no, I'm, you know, you need to stay out of this. And so Elwood and Turner get this job of going around the neighborhood and basically selling things that should be going to the Nickel Boys, to people in the community. And the Nickel Academy leases out their labor. So they're going around, and Elwood kind of tells Turner, like, I want to get the word out about like how bad this place is.
Wow.
And Turner's saying, you know, no, you should just, you know, again, just do what you got to do to get out of here. So the inspectors come to the school as they do every year. Elwood has written all of these things up, all of these notes of everything wrong that he's seen, and says, I'm going to give it to these people. And Turner's saying, don't do it.
Why would Turner want him to do it?
Because Turner knows that they're, even if they don't find out exactly who's told, that there's going to be punishment.
So he's basically like, the institution will always win. You just have to survive. And Elwood is like thinking again optimistically, and that we can make change.
Exactly.
Right.
And Turner's like, and if they find out that it's you specifically, he's going to kind of have the same fate as the kid in the boxing match.
Okay.
Like they have actively murdered children in this school.
Oh my God.
Like that's not unknown. And he's saying that is what is going to happen to you.
Yeah.
And so this, what's interesting is kind of like in the middle of the story, we switch time periods. So then we see Elwood as an adult.
Oh.
And he's moved to New York. He's kind of, obviously he's traumatized. He's kind of jaded. We no longer see this young man who really wants to go to college and really wants to have this like great life. He is able to kind of build up his own, business, and have a relationship, but you just see him as traumatized man. And, you know, you begin to kind of see both sides of like what it was like as for him as a child and what it was like for him as an adult. And then this is kind of where the twist comes in, and I'm trying to figure out like, do I say it? Do I not say it? I don't know.
Well, let's take a poll. Everybody out there, should we say it or not? Everyone say it. I don't know. I mean, to know. Does it have to do with Turner?
It does.
Oh, I sort of like Turner.
Well, okay, I'm going to say it, everyone.
All right.
All right. So I'm giving you fair warning. I'm going to say what's happening.
Okay. Spoiler alert. Okay.
So what happened is that Elwood and Turner kind of changes his mind for some reason and agrees that to help Elwood tell the people about what's happening. So he takes all of Turner's writings and he hands them over. I mean, Elwood's writing and hands them over.
Mm.
And when the people in the institution find out, obviously they know that there's going to be trouble. And they find out that it's Turner and Elwood. And Turner said, you and I have to escape. So they make this big escape from Nickel. They basically almost like, when you think of like the runaway slaves, like the Underground Railroad, like literally it's like that. Like, you know, they have this plan and they leave and they have bike, you know, it's a whole plan, but the people catch up with them and they have shotguns. And one of these boys does not make it.
Well,
I guess I should just say it. So it's so hard to speak about this, but anyway, sadly it's Elwood, and you don't think it's going to be Elwood.
Wait, I'm sorry, because you pick up in the future with Elwood.
Exactly.
Oh.
So what happens is Turner, who's always kind of living in fear from having escaped, decides to take on Elwood's identity.
Oh.
And he lives his life in the future, and you don't really find out that Elwood doesn't make it until the very end, because once you switch over to Elwood as an adult or Turner as an adult, it kind of goes back and forth in time.
Okay.
And you don't really find this out until the end. But he kind of does this, and you think he just does it to protect himself, but you also feel like he does this to really kind of honor him, and that he did really admire the way that Elwood thought. And what happens is in the very end, he does decide to go back and kind of testify against the people in the school, because the story is starting to kind of come out about how they treated people. And, you know, I'm going to try to wrap all this up. But, you know, it's just so many things in this to think about. You know, one of the things I thought was just like how the community really actually participated and was complicit in this school, how they used their labor, how they, how, you know, coming to these fights, and basically it was really just kind of the whole community that I believe was kind of implicit in this. And also, you know, just the trauma that they have in this. And there was some criticism that I read about of kind of the women's role in this book. So I thought that was interesting. And then of course, like you have the prison industrial complex part of it, and how innocent people are often, you know, especially young innocent Black boys are kind of, you know, have been put in these situations. But, you know, the final thing is this was a real, based on a real story, which was the Dozier School in Florida. Mm-hmm. And a group of archaeologists who are working on the site of the school found basically a mass grave of boys. And that's kind of when a group of the survivors of former students came out and began to really speak about their experiences at the school and the torture and the kind of the slave labor work and what was happening. And Colson Whitehead had heard about this story. He interviewed some of the survivors, and this is what he has, you know, based his book on. And a lot of it is kind of really accurate to what happened to them. It really was just like a horrible, horrible place. And, you know, there really hasn't been a lot of accountability yet of what has happened to these people. But, you know, again, it's these men kind of walking around with all of this trauma. Mm. And the story, the book, The Nickel Boys, actually is not long. You almost call it a novella, but there's just so much really just packed into it. And again, I feel like we could spend an hour kind of just going through each of the issues that this short novel brings up, but I spoiled it.
I know. Now I don't regret it. There's no regrets here.
Okay.
I know. You can't resist.
I know. This story is hard to talk about without this.
Colson Whitehead, because I read his other books, his writing is so good that it's, if you know that twist, I mean, to read it still is a different experience. Like my fist has been in my mouth with my eyes wide for the last 5 minutes. I've been like, so many things. Like, I mean, just even the core issue, like friendships between boys and two men, is so affecting to me too. Like I was thinking of A Little Life. I was thinking of, I can't think of the other title. Another book I read about a French author, Lie With Me. Just, you know, having that deep friendship. It just, I mean, I felt like tearful when you were talking about the switch and, you know, how you set up Turner and how, what Turner was like. There's sort of that trope of like, you know, the innocent and the sort of street savvy and how they become close and bond is just so poignant.
Yeah. It's a beautiful book. It's sad, very sad, but yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
You're good, honey. I want you to read bedtime stories.
No, sure. Anytime.
Not painful ones, but
just give me a call.
I know, right? Like, Rhonda, you're like, once upon a time, there was a little prince named Frankie.
Frankie. Okay, you got it.
An elderly person trying to, like, acting like a little boy. Thank you.
We should tell them what we're reading next.
Oh, yeah. Well, thanks for that, Rhonda. So, two interesting books this episode, I think. So for the next book, we're going to go back to the New York Public Library's books of 125 New York City books we love.
Mm-hmm.
And this one is a classic of short stories, The Stories of John Cheever, which I know you don't know a lot about. So we'll, you'll newly discover these stories. And on January 28th, we will discuss the stories of John Cheever. Rhonda, you'll read a couple. I'll read a couple. We see if we read the same. We'll see what conclusions we can come to. We'll see what kind of experience the stories of John Cheever is. So I know a little bit about him, but not much. So I'm looking forward to that. Hopefully everybody out there is too. Read the stories of John Cheever. And we'll keep working on our New York Public Library lists about books we love and see where we go from there. So it's been a pleasure, Rhonda.
As always, exactly.
Oh, thanks. I mean, hopefully, even reading the book I read about how materials change us, like just the being in person aspect, has been so long since I've seen you or talked to you in person or anybody really without a mask, is just gotta change things. I mean, it just feels so different. But anyway, hey.
Exactly.
One step at a time, one day at a time. What an emotional roller coaster. Okay.
It was.
Yeah, thank you. So thanks everybody for listening to The Librarian Is In. Hope you got some good recommendations. I can't stop talking. I'm going to shut up. Bye, everybody.
See you next time.
Thanks for listening to The Librarian Is In, a podcast by the New York Public Library. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Play, or send us an email at podcasts@nypl.org. For more information about the New York Public Library and our 125th anniversary, please visit nypl.org/125. We are produced by Christine Farrell. Your hosts are Frank Kalarius and Rhonda Evans.